You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24, Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Broken records, the albums you wouldn't shut up about. Broken records, the music our guests can't live without.
Like Judy,
Barbara,
Liza,
Bette,
Betty,
Audra,
Bernadette.
We broadcast this podcast with hopes that someday we might get Patti LuPone. Broken record, broken record, broken record, broken record, broken record.
Welcome to Ben Ramillo's Broken Records on Broadway World, Broadway Podcast Network, and Broadway On Demand.
Excuse me? I cannot hear you. Are you in a ball gag?
No.
It's this fucking mask, but I don't. What do? I take it off. I don't know where to put it. I don't want it to get all gross.
Well, it's fortunate that we have a solution to that now, because our first sponsor, Mask Motel, the solution to your mask taking off with nowhere to put it problems.
Don't get it all disgusting, germy, and COVID-y in your pocket with the rest of the bad shit. Put it in the Mask Motel.
It's like a little wallet. It's washable, reusable, antimicrobial lining to keep your mask fresh and germ-free when you're on the go. It has a cute little keychain ring that you can put on your purse, on your person, on your keys, whatever you want.
It comes in fashion colors, y'all.
Yes, 5 different color options. Right now, they're running a special 5 for $100. It's a perfect stocking stuffer. Get it on mask.com and
not mask.com, maskmotel.com. Mask.com.
Do not go to mask.com.
Mask.com is my personal website.
Yes, honey. Get it on maskmotel.com. And right now, if you enter the code PATTI, that's PATTI, at checkout, you get an immediate 10% off for being a Broken Records listener.
Oh my God, you can't afford not to buy these.
You can't. So go to maskmotel.com and get your life.
Well, for real now, y'all, for the cheap seats, can you see over, can you see okay over there at the bar? Can you? Welcome to Patti LuPone. I'm Le Mouche. I'm here to begin the masterclass. I don't know what I'm talking about. Welcome to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World, Broadway Podcast Network, and very possibly, you can't prove it's not true, Broadway On Demand.
Yes.
I am your lovely co-host, Ben Rimmelauer, and I'm here with good old reliable Daniel Nolan.
Danielle Nolan. I am here. I am queer, and I am bringing you Christmas cheer.
You sure are. You brought the Christmas cheer right into my life, girl.
Really?
That's the truth.
You know, I'm really just embracing fully my basic bitchness this year. I mean, as we talk right now, I'm burning my Bath & Body Works Twisted Peppermint 14-ounce candle. And I just turned off my fireplace on my TV. I have the digital fireplace from Netflix going most days.
Wow.
So we need a little Christmas more than ever this year, you know?
Yes, we do. And on that note, we should begin this episode by saying rest in peace to Broadway goddess Rebecca Luker, who passed at far too young from ALS, only 59 years old. And it is really, It's such a devastating loss. You know, I got a text message about it just as we were starting to record. And I thought, you know, our podcast is sort of like archival in a way, especially these quarantine streams when we talk about something old, like today's episode is about the fabulous movie White Christmas. So, you know, this we want this episode to be for any point in time. And because we do have a live stream video show next year, some year that's on every Tuesday at noon. So it's, you know, that's maybe a place to address current events. But I just thought, you know, Rebecca Luker is such a part of the canon of Broadway history, definitive Broadway. And we have to, first of all, mention her every chance we get and preserve her memory for all time. And, you know, there's just, will never be not the right time to remember just the glory of her. And I'm so grateful that I got to see her on stage in several musicals, including, I guess the first thing I saw her in was The Secret Garden, that she was just
fabulous.
So ethereal and singular in that. And the last thing I saw her in was something totally different, and she was just really wonderful and moving, was when she replaced Judy Kuhn on Broadway in Fun Home.
Oh, that's right. I'm really sad I didn't see her in that. I never saw her on stage.
This would have been a great one, because she was, you know, obviously she sang it gorgeously. I mean, Judy Kuhn, like Rebecca, is a soprano, but Judy's also a belter, and that part was not exactly like a coloratura, you know, particularly like lyric soprano kind of role. Any opera fans, classical music people out there are like turning over, you know, they're rolling their eyes. Coloratura and lyric are different things. You don't know what you're talking about. But I'm just saying, you know, it was not that kind of a part in that vein of like classical style singing. However, of course, Rebecca sang it with absolute purity and beauty. And what was, you know, not surprising, I suppose, but, you know, just really gratifying was what a terrific acting performance it was. And I think that maybe sometimes, because the beauty of her voice lent to her often being cast in these sort of, you know, I don't want to say bland, but, you know, these ingenue roles that were maybe less dynamic, it was really wonderful to see her just give a really gutsy, edgy, and compelling acting performance in something modern like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I've seen plenty of clips of her. I think we mentioned her a few episodes of our live stream ago on Name That Belt. Yeah. And just a singular voice, a singular talent, and she will be missed. Rest in peace, Rebecca Luker. We'll definitely be talking about her more on Tuesday on the live stream. All right. Well, with that said, let's get into our film this week. Okay. So what did you think of White Christmas? Was this your first time? This wasn't your first time watching it.
Here's the deal. I am really glad I watched it. As I've learned to try to be a better collaborator with you, even when you suggest something I'm not that psyched for, I try to just roll over and take it like a bitch. I believe I did not say boo when you said White Christmas. But I was not that psyched for it, and I really enjoyed it. I saw it once before, which was like maybe 15 years ago, when my then roommate Brian Cruey, shout out to Brian Cruey, all the Brian Cruey fans, had made me watch it because it was his favorite movie. He, like yourself, is like a good Christian boy from a small town in Kentucky. And we were so drunk and stoned, I'm sure, when we watched it at that time in like 2003 or 2004 or whatever.
Fabulous.
That I don't remember that much about it, except that I already knew a lot of the songs, which were Irving Berlin standards, like Sisters and, of course, White Christmas and
Count Your Blessings.
Count Your Blessings and
Blue Skies.
Blue Skies. Yes, totally. So that, but I was not that psyched to watch it again. And it continues to surprise me that the movie that all these like white American Christians feel so connected to as your Christmas holiday movie is this movie like about these like Jews in show business. I mean, this gay Jew, Danny Kaye, just like, you know. So that was like my like first thought. My first thought when it started, I have to say, was just like rolling the credits. I was like, yay, Mary Wicks. I get so excited when Mary Wicks is in something.
Mary Wicks is fantastic in this movie, and she has a pretty big role. I mean, she's such a character actress that a lot of times she's just a little bit part, but she's really the one who kind of initiates the huge plot twist at the end, the big misunderstanding that results in, you know, the conflict between Rosemary and Bing.
Which I have to say, maybe because my standards were so low after Bells Are Ringing, I did not feel like this was as stupid of an old school like movie plot as that had felt like. Also, just on Mary Wicks. Well, first of all, my most recent love for Mary Wicks that was on the Corn Streams. Oh no, it wasn't on the Corn Streams. We did. I was like, did we Corn Stream Postcards from the Edge? We did not. Feels like we did. But she plays Shirley MacLaine's mother in that.
Oh, I forgot that.
But of course, she's in a million things that we all grew up on. Sitcoms and movies.
Act.
And not for nothing, that role has been beefed up in the touring stage version of White Christmas that they do all over the country. That's the part that Lorna Luft plays, or
interesting.
Ruth Williamson, Pamela Myers, those broads.
Well, I'm glad to hear your take on it and to hear you say it doesn't seem stupid, because I mean, I've seen this movie so many times. I mean, I watch it every year, but multiple times a year. You know, I've seen it so many times I just leave it on in the background sometimes. I mean, maybe besides like Some Like It Hot, I think this is the movie I've seen the most, probably out of any movie ever, just because I grew up watching it so much. So now I can't really see it objectively, you know, just because I'm so – most of the time I just like it for nostalgic purposes. So it's great to hear kind of an objective viewpoint. Because I was like, maybe, you know, maybe I'm seeing it with rose-colored glasses because I'm so – sentimental about it. But I mean, I think I'm always just drawn in immediately again. And the huge production numbers, and I think Rosemary's such a great actress in it. And
she's great. She's really great. And I enjoyed all their performances. Like, I don't know why I'm feel kind of snobby towards Bing Crosby. Like, what did he ever do to me? What have I ever seen him in? But just like, I'm never like, ooh, yay, Bing Crosby. But like, he's great. Danny Kaye is like so great. Rosemary is absolutely just like flawless. And like, Vera Ellen, I don't know. I don't think I have another. Well, I guess I've seen her in On the Town, but I didn't really love that movie, but I love her in this. I think she's so like just like gorgeous and sassy and great.
I mean, it was such good casting because you know, Vera was such a dancer. I mean, just an amazing dancer. She was also, I think, in the Call Me Madam movie, which I haven't seen.
Yes, she is, but that movie has one star only.
But, you know, Vera was this amazing, amazing dancer, and Rosemary was an amazing singer who didn't really dance. So, you know, Vera gets all these amazing numbers where she's the featured dancer. And then Rosemary actually did the singing for both of them. they dubbed Vera's, lip syncing with Rosemary's vocals. And of course, Rosemary also gets her huge numbers to shine. Love You Didn't Do Right by Me.
Yes,
you
know, yes.
In the big production numbers, she gets the kind of intro bit, just kind of standing there laughing and talking with the two guys. And I mean, I think I've always kind of had a bad taste
hold
in my mouth.
Back to the lip sync for a second. So you're saying to me that in this movie, you hear both Rosemary Clooney, Vera Ellen, Bing Crosby, and Danny Kaye all lip sync to Rosemary Clooney's pre-recorded voice. this movie is like RuPaul's Drag Race.
Rosemary just did the vocals for herself and Vera. I mean,
the guys lip sync to Sisters.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, yes, absolutely.
Like,
they're all lip syncing.
So crazy.
Rosemary. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, this was Rosemary. I think there's that movie Red Garters, which I've never seen. But this is Rosemary's really only big film credit. And I've always kind of had a bad taste in my mouth for Bing, even though I think they were close. But I think, you know, when before Rosemary was cast in this, they thought she was too old for the part.
Yeah.
And Bing was like, you know, 20 years older than her anyway. So they literally wanted someone sexist younger
Hollywood.
Than her.
Yeah.
Sexist Hollywood. So for some reason, that always put a bad taste in my mouth. But, you know, Bing was a huge singing star. And, you know, he sounds great. But for my money, Rosemary and Danny Kaye are just like the heart and soul
yes,
of this
yes.
piece.
I mean, are you attracted to Danny Kaye in this movie?
No. I mean, I'm not like sexually, but I mean,
sexually.
I mean, I'm very drawn to him as like, oh my God, he's a star. The
yeah,
charisma.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, you sound like them. What does she say? Which one? Doesn't matter. They're both famous.
What does it matter? They're both famous.
My real dream for this, because it's just got, I love that like showbiz talk that they constantly
yes.
engage in.
Oh my God, constant.
I want like a downtown, like reverse gender production. Like, I think Molly Pope should be like Danny Kaye. I mean, should be Bing Crosby, and Natalie Joy Johnson should be Danny Kaye.
Oh my God, amazing, amazing. Who would be gender reversed girls? Who would play like what males would play the Rosemary and Vera parts?
Like Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Perfect, perfect. Anyway, so I mean, and I think, you know, speaking more about Rosemary, she's so amazing, singular voice, but I think she's such a great actress in this movie. I just think her act, I mean, she plays that kind of steely, distrustful, independent Betty so well. And you know, whenever busybody Emma overhears, you know, the wrong patch of conversation on the phone and then tells Betty. I mean, I always have to just, you know, tell myself that it's all going to work out because I get so mad at that part. But, you know, then Rosemary immediately just turns against Bing and does her own thing. And I just think, you know, she is so committed to that and she plays it so well that their chemistry is just like heightened until the end, of course, when she shows up to do the army number and he's so happy.
Yeah.
I love it so much. And I mean, it's the technicolor of it all. Now that I watch it, you know,
is it Vista color?
Yeah. Vista Vision, the first film in Vista Vision.
Ooh. about the songs, like just like as a musical theater person, like, I mean, I love that. I'm trying to figure out like what the world of this movie is like, because like, they don't really sing like, it's what is it? I forget which means what. Like the songs are not diegetic, or the songs are diegetic. It's one or the other, because they sing them like as their characters performing. Although they definitely take liberties where like they just like will perform anytime. Hey, you want to hear a song I wrote? Let me sing two verses, and then she's like, "Let's have an emotional conversation," and then I'll jump in on the third verse.
Right.
But they live in this world where every song that you could hear anywhere happens to be written by Irving Berlin. And I guess he wrote like a couple of these for the movie, but they also just felt free to just like pull from the Irving Berlin, just like any old Irving Berlin song they wanted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That little montage at the beginning, they throw in a lot of them.
That's the songs I was trying to think of that I couldn't like, with just like Blue Skies and just like
Heatwave.
Yes. Heatwave. Yeah. Thank you. And it's just like, can you imagine if there was like this, like a, like, you know, a Bobby and Kristen Lopez like movie musical where like randomly there's songs from like Book of Mormon, Frozen.
Right. I mean, it kind of reminds me of like, what was Till the Clouds Roll By? And it's the Jerome Kern.
But that's like
musical.
A biopic.
Right. He's actually a character in it. But, yeah, I mean, the Wallace and Davis team or whatever, it's so many movies, musical movies back in the day did this. It's like they were about composers, you know, like they wrote about show business. It wasn't like the opposite of diegetic, whatever that is, where it's, you know, like Yentl, like she's just singing by herself in a field, you know.
Yeah.
It's like actually about show business, the process of putting on a show, casting, chorus girls, all of that.
Yeah.
And this thing I think this film is so, it gives it that extra little layer, is that it asks the question, you know, through Betty's character, kind of, can you be a good person and be in show business? Or, you know, do you have to have like this selfish angle, like the yes. thing that Bing brings up at the beginning? Yeah. Like, do you have to have an agenda? Are you always looking to get something, or can you love someone despite their fame or connections? Yeah. And she seems to be kind of the one pulling for that theme. And then of course it gets all fucked up because of Busybody Mary Wicks. But yeah, I mean, and the thing I love about it, you know, I'm a sucker for anything on a train, plane, or boat. And the fact that there's a huge sequence on this cozy little, you know, passenger train when they sit in the diner car and sing Snow and, you know, drink their like milkshakes or whatever.
I love that on this train, like you buy like a sleeping berth that's like, you know, bunk beds like in the public mm-hmm. hallway, but then mm-hmm. you get a private living room.
Yeah. Back then trains were all the rage back then. And things were like, crazy.
The train is sold out. There are no tickets. Oh, you can pay and just sit in the club car, which is completely empty all night.
Yeah. Instead of like, you know, like RuPaul's Drag Race on tour style, just sleeping in a bunk bed with a curtain. Yeah. Anyone could come by and disturb you. Mm. I mean, and the fact that the price of the admission or the price of the train is, it's so expensive. It's like almost $100. I'm like, back then that was like $700. I mean, train travel was not cheap.
Yeah. What is up with that?
I'm always so shocked at that. But I love that.
Like, I want to like do a deep dive in like what things cost in the old days. Like why were they like, oh, for a nickel, you could have a night out on the town. But like, you can't afford to go to Vermont on the train in the club car.
Exactly. Well, I've always been told 1950s, because of I know this because of I Love Lucy, and this movie was made in the 50s as well. They say multiply it by maybe more nowadays, but you know, back in the early aughts, they said multiply it by 7, and that will give you kind of like today's value of what things cost. So, you know, on Lucy or whatever, they're always like, oh, like, can I have, you know, $5 to get a new pair of shoes? And it's like, well, that would be what, 30 nowadays?
But then there's also like weird things like inflation 35. And like, or, you know, things like real estate markets where like houses would have cost like $5,000 that are now $1 million, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, but that's, you know, what keeps me coming back to this movie is just the cozy interior scenes, the, you know, Vermont Inn surrounded by snow, with, you know, Vera Ellen and the general and his granddaughter, Susan, and everyone's just so happy and cozy. And Vera Ellen and Danny Kaye fall in love. They come up with this harebrained scheme, which is just so cruel, just like gaslighting Betty into thinking they're together and she needs to go off and find a man. And, yeah, I mean, I just love it. It just makes me feel so, so cozy and like I'm there with them.
Yeah. I mean,
which is really what it's about for me.
Oh, interesting. So when you watch this movie, do you feel like you're hanging out with your friends?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, again, I've seen it so much. It's the same reason I love watching Murder, She Wrote, especially the Cabot Cove episodes, because it's like, I know Jessica's apartment. I know she's like, you know, brewing coffee and Seth's about to come over for a slice of pie. And it's just like homey and familiar. So when I put on this movie, it's the same thing. I've seen it so many times that it's like, oh, okay, time to go back to the club car, time to go to the nightclub in Miami. And it feels like stuff that, you know, we would do going to Provincetown or Fire Island. You know, it's like resorty and vacation-y, and the whole movie is that. The whole movie is like a vacation trip, basically.
I mean, I love early in the movie when Danny Kaye and Vera Ellen are dancing and they just kind of like waltz right out of the room onto like the like terrace. And I mean, it's so cheesy because it's like the backdrop for like the like beach in Miami is like, it's like a indoor swimming pool with like it looks more like fake snow than fake sand, but there's like palm trees and stuff. But it's kind of like that magical thing that we talk about, like in the song Begin the Begin, of like down by the shore and orchestras playing, you know?
Yeah. And I love that. It starts out in, you know, Southern Florida, and then it goes up to Vermont. So you get all the seasons, all the temps. And I don't know. It's just, the Technicolor of it all, it's just a very warm, bright, happy film. You know, and I always get a little teary and misty whenever the general comes in and all his men are there on Christmas Eve to see him and support him. And
he was a good character. I also like, what do you, the minstrel thing, they sort of like, I mean, I wonder, I mean, thank God they at least just do it with like red gloves, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so this movie was kind of based on Holiday Inn, which came, you know, before it, and also starred Bing Crosby, and the song White Christmas was originally sung in that film.
I saw that on Broadway, but I've never seen that movie.
Yes, I've only seen the movie once, and some people think it's superior just because it was first, and you know, it's a classic black and white film. But they do the minstrel number, and it's total blackface, and it's like a, you know, extended blackface number, so it's very uncomfortable watching it now.
I mean, I it's interesting that they, you know, if I wouldn't have necessarily known whether to guess in 1954 when they made White Christmas, if they would have sort of, you know, what do you call it? Like whitewashed the blackface, so to speak. Mm-hmm. With the, you know, I mean, cause they all wear red gloves. And it seems like maybe like some of them might be wearing a little extra like tanning lotion, but I don't know if that's real or not.
Spray on tan.
Like yeah. Vera Ellen's legs were like really dark in that number.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you know, blackface is a thing, and like that's not blackface, you know? They are celebrating a minstrel show, but like, you know, certainly for like a kid watching that, like, I don't think you would necessarily have any idea what it's about.
No, you know? I never knew what that was until like, you know, however old I was when I figured out what that meant. But as a kid watching it, I had no idea what a minstrel show was.
I didn't check, but I'm pretty sure that when they do like the Lorna Luft tour nowadays, it like does not have that number.
Well, there is that. And then I think in Holiday Inn, there's it spans the whole year. It's not just a Christmas movie. It's like, they start with like Lincoln's birthday in February, and someone sings a song about Abraham Lincoln. And in this movie, there's a line Danny Kaye says. He says like, "Let's try the Abraham number," which in Holiday Inn, I remember it being a little bit problematic, sung by a black actress. And but in White Christmas, it's just kind of a quick dance number with no words at all, just Vera Ellen and one of those chorus men.
Speaking dancing. Of that, those chorus men, how hot is that lead dancer guy?
Ah, so much.
I think his name is John Brascia or Brascia or something.
Hmm. There's also one of the four in Love You Didn't Do Right with Rosemary at the Carousel Club. He went on to be in. He played a big role in the West Side Story musical. Mm. I can't remember which guy, but yeah, I always like to watch in these old movies. All these chorus men, I'm like, I wonder how many of these were quote straight and stayed straight their whole career, and how many like were secretly having, you know, gay affairs on the side.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because this guy, like, I looked him up and, like, he definitely was, like, straight. He actually kind of seemed, like, convincingly straight because he was married to, like, a bunch of different women over his life. I don't know. I don't know why I consider that to be convincingly straight, but it's
like a playboy.
Yeah. But I mean, I didn't even know he was going to be a dancer. In his first appearance in White Christmas, they're just, like, unpacking at the resort. And he, like, barks out something about, like, you know, girl dancers are in the cabins on the left, or I don't know, you know, whatever he says.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, I was like, oh, hi, company manager.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he just, I mean, if I have ever seen, what do they say? Gay face is when you look like you just smelled fresh baked cookies.
Yes.
I was like, I want to get all up in his Nestle Toll House, girl.
Honey, you just smelled fresh baked sandwiches and buttermilk.
Yes, yes. But then I was so happy that he turned out to be in so much more of the movie. But
Yeah, I always notice all, I mean, and the thing is, I mean, some of it's a little or a lot unbelievable. It's like they're at this little Vermont inn and, you know, this little stage in this hall, and then it cuts to these huge musical numbers, and it's like just like hundreds and hundreds of people on stage. You're like, that doesn't seem logical. I mean, again, you know, I always think of, you know, the Ziegfeld numbers from like Funny Girl, His Love Makes Me Beautiful. I mean, back then they did not, you know, no expense spared.
Totally.
They like to have a complete chock full stage of people, props, costumes, everything.
Well, look, even when the two sisters, when Rosemary Clooney and Vera Ellen show up at the resort for their gig, which is then canceled initially. They're, you know, they're told we'll pay you your 50% cancellation fee, but there's literally nobody at the resort. And they're like, you know, they wind up saying they're going to do it anyway because Bing Crosby and everything. But like, but that show has like a full band, like just the two girls. Yeah. Like, was that band going to get the cancellation fee? Like, does the band just like on retainer at the hotel all the time?
Yeah, they're just always there.
I just love that old show business. Oh, also back to like the whole like Jewishness of it all. Like,
yes.
One thing Bing Crosby says to Danny Kaye early on is, you utzed me along or something.
Oh yeah, you utzed me along every step of the way.
Yeah, like he's talking Yiddish.
That is so funny. Again, like I've seen it so many times, I've never, you know, even picked up on that. But
and by the way, that's not even so like common Yiddish. Like, I only know that word because my sister uses it. But my sister, in a very like anachronistic, like not our generation way, Lucy, mm-hmm. like Lucy Rimmelauer, like is like very fluent in Yiddish. It's just like she like pulls out words that like I have never heard that my parents don't even use, like. But, like, that's where I know Utz from. And I can't believe, like, Bing Crosby. Like, I feel like if I would have guessed, I would have thought, wouldn't Bing Crosby be, like, an anti-Semite or something?
But, I'm like, sure.
No, here he is, like, talking Yiddish.
Right, right. It's so true. It's so show busy. And it's so, well, come on, we got to go see this sister act. I got a letter from an Arby pal asking for a favor. You know, it's just so, like, all that.
But also that time, as you said, so many things were about show business.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know that, like, America at that time was really, like, sort of seduced by the glamour of what Hollywood and Broadway were supposed to be or, you know, were or whatever.
Post-war.
Mm-hmm. But, like, it's funny because I've kind of, like, grown up thinking that, like, artistically you need to, like, not do that. Like, I... you know, as a teenager, like getting into Sondheim and everything and like wanting to work myself in musical theater, like I always thought like, oh, the reason that Merrily We Roll Along didn't succeed was because people didn't find these characters likable when it was about them trying to make it in show business, you know? And, you know, and in a broader scale, you know, maybe I thought that about Follies or like even Sunday in the Park with George, this, you know, it's not show business, but the idea that it's about this artist and his work is like inaccessible to a general audience. And like, I always sort of took that as like, you know, one of like the lessons or something. And
yeah,
it's interesting to think about like the exceptions to that. I mean, I'm trying to think like, are there... it's so hard to even compare anything nowadays because we're in such like a reality TV kind of era. So it's like, you know, I think we are very interested in like behind the scenes of like actual working artists, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, nowadays, you know, I immediately think of like La La Land, which is all about, it's more about the film industry, but, it's kind of an insider-y take on that. And then, before that.
But that was also like such a throwback La La Land.
Yeah. And definitely influenced by, you know, these huge mega musicals of the 50s and Bells Are Ringing, Our Last Cornstream. You know, he is a writer.
Yes,
and,
totally.
And she's trying to get him to write. And then, well, I think American in Paris, he's also a songwriter. Mm-hmm. And So it's, yeah, it was a really good thing back then.
But I mean, am I just forgetting that there are more things about that nowadays? And I'm just like not giving
it. Musicals or just movies?
Even just movies, you know, or like, I guess even TV shows. Like,
I mean, I always hear, you know, Birdman, that movie that won Best Picture. Yes.
But
years
that was
ago.
Like an art movie. And it was sort of, you know, I mean, it was, and, you know, it wasn't necessarily like a blockbuster, like mainstream right. kind of thing other than the Oscars.
I just remember people saying, Hollywood loves movies about Hollywood. You know, Hollywood loves movies about itself or behind the scenes right. or what yeah. goes on. But I don't know, you know, like you're saying, I don't know if that really translates to an audience.
Yeah.
A wide I mean, audience.
But maybe it can. I mean, you know, I mean, honestly, maybe the Sondheim shows flopped because like people found Sondheim's work inaccessible, not the subject matter.
Right.
Know?
I mean, also think about The Prom, you know, it was a big hit. And now the Netflix.
It was not a big hit.
Kind of a hit.
It was a flop.
Was it?
Yeah, it was absolutely a flop.
Well, now the movie is, you know, this huge, big budget film, and it's
because Ryan Murphy wanted to make it, and he's fascinated right. with that. But I haven't heard whether the movie has been successful or not. You know, I know the reviews were mixed. But I do think though that like, you know, Ryan Murphy's not alone in that. Obviously, he's tapped into something. I mean, look at Glee. You know, I mean, it's the reality. You know, I watched this documentary on the plane called Jawline. Have you heard of that?
Mm-mm.
It's produced by Hulu. It's on Hulu. And it's fascinating. It's about this 16-year-old, maybe even younger, this boy, this teenage boy who's trying to become a social media star from a very poor family in a teeny town in Tennessee, I think it is. I think it's Tennessee. He's the main focus of the movie, although it also looks at these other kids who sort of are what he's aspiring to be, you know, that have hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram and these other apps.
Yeah.
And that and this fascinating character who was referred to as the Louis B. Mayer of social media. This 22-year-old gay guy in LA named Michael Wiest, who is a manager of social media stars, and all his clients are like 17-year-old, like Insta hotties. And he has this house that they all live in, and it's like a farm. And he'll be like, you haven't, but he's a kid too, you know? I mean, and it doesn't seem like he's using them for sex or anything. He's like, I think he's like making them stars and making money off them, you know? But he's like, it's 10 a.m. Go make a video. And the guy's like, I'm hungry. He's like, have a protein bar and get on cam, you know? And,
oh my God, this is like an old Judy Garland movie, it's like Summer Stock or
Daniel, you know, you have to watch it. It is so fascinating.
It's like a modern version of like those old school film when they go to camp and put on shows.
Totally, or Stage Door, you know.
Yeah, Stage Door.
You have to watch this. I mean, I think it screams out. I think it should be a musical.
I was going to say, our friend TBJ should help write it, Jake Shears.
Yeah. It's like you've got to watch the movie. I was crying, I was laughing, I loved it. But that movie I think was very acclaimed at Sundance and all that. So I think that like you know, maybe more to the point, people are interested in like show business behind the scenes stuff now. They're just not that interested in Broadway, you know.
Yeah.
Which is why, totally. Like, you know, Smash was not successful.
Right. That's very true. Very true. I mean, and also it's so, you know, even Smash with these semi-big TV and film stars in it, it's so insidery, you know, like even me who was into Broadway and into theater, you know, seeing clips of Smash now, I'm like, oh my God, I didn't realize she was in this, or I had no idea who this was back then. And, you know, these cameos by these Broadway people. And
yeah, but those were like Easter eggs. I mean, I think Smash,
right.
I don't think that's, you needed to get that to get Smash.
No, I'm just saying like, it's very, the Broadway community is not super recognizable or super known and the ins and outs of Broadway aren't super known to the general public.
Sure. But I mean, that aspect, I think that was almost more like The Good Wife or something, where it's like you film a show in New York, Law and Order, you know, you're going to have Anne Harada, you're going to have Carolee Carmello. That doesn't, you know, the stars of the show were the stars of, you know, Will and Grace and, you know, The Grifters and American Idol, you know. I don't know. Is The Grifters Angelica Houston's biggest credit? I wasn't sure what to leave with.
I was like, who? The Witches. I mean, Addams Family.
Yes, Addams Family. There it is. Speaking of Carolee Carmello.
Speaking of Carolee Carmello, and when are we not?
Have you, by the way, I never saw the musical of the Addams Family. Did you?
I did not either. I did not.
I wish that I had.
I wasn't even in New York, I don't think, whenever it was on. But I'd never seen it. But I mean, I do know, I think when I was in Oklahoma, it was coming through touring a lot and there were regional productions. So it's one of those shows that definitely has a life still.
It's weird. You know, Andrew Lippa wrote the score to that. And I loved the score that he wrote for The Wild Party, the off-Broadway Wild Party. But I haven't really kept up with him. Like, I know he wrote The Addams Family and he wrote Shrek. And I never saw either one of them.
I watched Shrek on Netflix a few years ago and it was okay.
I've never even seen, like, the real Shrek.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know what I read recently, but something I saw said that it was recently inducted into, like, some, you know, historically and aesthetically significant film list, like Shrek from 2000, whatever, which it is. It's like a great movie and it was a hit, but it's just funny. It's like this green ogre is like a historically significant film. But I remember liking it. And I liked the show when I saw it on Netflix, but it was good. It just, you know, Shrek's not really my thing. But, you know, Sutton putting on a fat suit, being an ogre. We have to stand.
I thought that was Brian D'Arcy James.
That was such an interesting... Go ahead, go on.
Are you making jokes like over my head?
That was in that weird run of shows that Sutton was doing right after...
Oh, God, it was relentless.
Millie, the Drowsy Chaperone,
Little Women. She wouldn't stop. And then worst of all, the show,
Young Frankenstein.
The show that was a smack in the face of all that is good and holy.
Which was?
Anything Goes.
Oh, right. That was the grand finale.
How very dare she.
Yeah. 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 What, I mean, I guess Music Man's coming up, but. I guess I saw her in Violet, which I did not like, but...
I didn't love Violet. I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Jeanine Tesori, even though I like Fun Home. Mm-hmm. But I thought Sutton was fine in Violet. I mean, I thought she was good. I didn't think it would have been better with somebody else.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, do we have anything else to say about White Christmas?
Let me check my notes.
Check your notes.
Well, also, like, I mean, this is so random, but do you kind of think maybe that... Vera Ellen has a little bit of a Nicole Kidman quality, like facially speaking.
Yeah, totally. Oh, it's funny you bring that up because, you know, she was a dancer, which rumors, you know, that maybe she had an eating disorder. But the reason she was in every scene, she has her outfits have a really high collar. It's because she had a really thin neck and because of that, her neck had aged prematurely. So she was really self-conscious about her neck. So that's why in all her costumes, they're high-collared.
Oh, my God. I can't with you, Hollywood.
Because she had her neck look... I mean, as Nora Ephron says, I feel bad about my neck. So, you know, but she was so thin, just like teeny, teeny, tiny. And then Rosemary, you know, was seen by many in the biz as too fat. Even though she was, you know, just a curvy, beautiful woman.
It's funny because when you think of Rosemary Clooney, like as she came to be, you can only watch her in this movie and think she's so little.
I know. In context, she really is the thinnest ever. I was reading about her as well. I love her so much, but I've never read any books. I mean, I think she's written several memoirs, autobiographies, but I've never read anything by her or about her. But from the research I've done, she had really a tough go of it. I think she was bipolar and she was a lifelong smoker and died from lung cancer. But I think she was addicted to pills early on. And
I think she got that all together, though. I mean, the only thing I've read about her is a book called The Night and the Music. And it chronicles three Titanic cabaret stars in the 90s. And it's Rosemary Clooney, Julie Wilson, and Barbara Cook. And it goes back and forth chapter by chapter between the three of them over the course of a year while they're playing major engagements. Rosemary's playing at the Carlisle. And of course, Rosemary's playing at Rainbow and Stars in this book. And I guess maybe she does one at Rainbow and Stars and one at the Carlisle. And she, long runs. I mean, she plays each of those gigs for like 6 weeks or something, you know, where she's doing seven shows a week and she's doing all the major TV interviews. I mean, it's a level of sort of, you know, mainstream cabaret that like
doesn't really exist.
It really only ever existed in the modern times with Rosemary Clooney, I would think.
Yeah.
That would
be a good musical.
She's up for a Grammy and all that. Yeah, it would be, actually. You should read it because it certainly portrays the third act of her life, which is much more happy and peaceful than I guess what she went through with the addiction issues and financial problems and her tumultuous marriage to Jose Ferrer.
Yes. Well, and that's so it seems so spot on in relation to my interest with Rosemary, because I actually prefer her later stuff. You know, there's a bunch. I mean, there's so many albums. I don't even know if they're all on Spotify, but there are a few on Spotify from the 90s where she was kind of in that phase. And they're so, so good. I mean, it's like Barbara Cook, you know, aged like a fine wine. She just sounds, in the videos too, it's just so grounded.
That said, when she started singing Love You Didn't Do Right By Me, a song that I actually know very well from listening to Rosemary Clooney albums from the olden days, or maybe it's just on some compilation, but it comes up for me a lot. I did not know that was going to be in this movie, and I lived for it. It made me want to watch Rosemary Clooney just stand in a fancy gown and sing old-fashioned big numbers with people dancing to her sides for an hour.
Totally. And that dress she wears is so beautiful. I mean, she's also such a great example of, I always talk about Marilyn, but Marilyn did it well. It's like those old stars who don't have dance training or minimal dance training, but they have such presence that the director, choreographer, whoever – works around them, and they know how to stage everything around them and create a space for them that highlights, their voice and charisma, but also just their stage presence that doesn't really require them to do much choreography. Very minimal.
Yeah.
You know, and even in that number, Rosemary, you know, lifts her arms and, you know, a few angles here and there, but it's all those four guys who are doing all the heavy lifting dance wise. Right. She's just, you know, the fabulous center of it all.
Living the dream.
I love that scene at the Carousel Club. I mean, first of all, just the Carousel Club, the fact that ever existed in New York is just so fantastic. Back whenever there was just like dozens of nightclubs. It's a type of thing that really doesn't exist that much anymore. But with that said, I've been watching a lot of TCM this week. They've been doing their every night's like a slew of kind of holiday adjacent movies. And last night I watched Shop Around the Corner, which is a movie with Jimmy Stewart. It's what You've Got Mail and She Loves Me. It's the source material for those.
Isn't it Jimmy Stewart and Judy Garland?
No, it's Jimmy Stewart and, what's her name? Margaret Sullivan. But then also on TCM right now is In the Good Old Summertime, which is with Judy Garland, which is a remake of Shop Around the Corner.
Oh, I'm so confused.
So it's just like there's so much, you know, In the Good Old Summertime, She Loves Me, You've Got Mail.
I've seen In the Good Old Summertime. I loved it. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's next on my list. Yeah, but they all come from Shop Around the Corner, which is...
In the Good Old Summertime is where she works in the music shop.
Yes. And in Shop Around the Corner, it's like She Loves Me. It's like a jewelry, you know, knick-knack store or whatever.
And She Loves Me, it's a parfumery.
Parfumery, yes. Anyway, well, anything else to say to the listeners before we sign off?
Just I want to wish them a Merry Christmas with lots of presents to make them happy.
Yes, yes. Someday soon we all will be together. If the fates allow, until then we'll have to muddle through somehow. All right. Bye, Ben.
Bye, Daniel. Thanks for listening to Ben Rimmelauer's Broken Records on Broadway World. For more episodes, visit Broadway World, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts do be.
This episode was edited by me, Daniel Nolan.
Thanks to Emmy-winning composer and lyricist Lance Horn for the Broken Records theme song.
Follow us both, Ben Rimmelauer and Daniel Nolan, on all y'all's socials.
That's Ben Rimmelauer. BenRimmelauer.
And that's Nolan with an E, not Nolan with an A.
Nolan with an A, isn't it? Ass.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.